Welcome to the Anime Podcast. Today, we're actually going to be looking into the future. Often in this podcast, we're wistfully looking at the past, or if not wistfully, at least using it as a framework to tell you the present. Where today, we're actually going to be looking at, as a two-part episode, first, we're going to be looking at how science feeds into capitalism and how we can potentially use technology and inventions to build the anarchist future that we hope for. And in the second episode, we'll be looking at science fiction as a genre and examining that and how it feeds into anarchist theory. So I am your host. I am James, who's going under the Jitsi handle of what the fuck is my Jitsi? Oh yeah, Cyberspunk. We have got Alex, who is Blade Runner is Optimistic. How are you getting on, Alex?
Well, I spent my morning drinking coffee and watching Denis Villeneuve's Blade Runner 2049, which despite, well, we'll learn more about that in the second episode, but, well, I'll leave it at that.
Our Blade Runner Electric Boogaloo, as I get to call it. And
There's room there for a trilogy. Don't tempt Denis Villeneuve.
Yeah, and we've also got Dan with us, who is going under the Jitsi handle of Elon Muskrat. How are you getting on, Dan?
It's elongated Muskrat. I'm cool. Just been using the wonders of technology to search for gasket for double glazing windows. So that's fun.
Gasket is the future.
Tungsten carbide drill.
This is meant to be a futuristic episode, Alex, not a reference of comedy of the past, I think you'll believe. So let's just get things started. Nice, easy question. How does technology feed into capitalism? And we'll start with Dan first to give us a brief overview, and then Alex, you can go into a more Marxist historical standpoint of that question.
I think essentially, in the modern age, it's all about maximizing profit to whilst minimizing sort of it's about maximizing profit while minimizing the amount you have to pay, and in which case the technology feeds into capitalism in the sense that it's made things a lot more efficient, where people, you can get sort of less people working to produce the same amount or more and still only pay them pittance. And, you know, where, oh God, I'm really fucking this up. Sorry, I've had a tramadol earlier because my back's fucked. So it's just brain's gone a bit. But yeah, basically it's sort of technology has managed to maximize production whilst minimizing workforce. So it's basically sort of a capitalist wet dream. The only problem with that being that you don't actually have any people left to buy your product.
You don't even need that anymore, Dan, because you just need to keep buying your own shares. So it's not even a big deal anymore. That's why the fucking stock market's blowing up, and Elon Musk rat has increased his value by 5 times because he's just buying his own stocks.
Yeah, as we discussed in the episode about the stock market is pretty much not linked to anything that you would imagine that capitalism doesn't exist in what we call the actual real world or the real economy. It's a thing of its own where it's just a fancy gambling that rich people can do. So Alex, if you want to delve into, say, let's not go back too far, but maybe say how technology and capitalism sort of go hand in hand with mercantilism and people like Adam Smith. If you want to sort of give us a crash course of, you know, the 1600s to now when it comes to technology and capitalism.
Not too great a task. I mean, without going too far back into time, like the fucking Gutenberg's printing press, we don't think we need to go that far. But if you go back to really the mid-18th century, the kind of all the great technological advances and inventions came out of Scotland, really. To some extent, Britain, England as well, but heavily Scotland. Certainly the steam engine, the first kind of modern version of the steam engine was created in Scotland in the 1740s, I think. Anyway, the point is that it's always been hand in hand with capital, because once you had the banking system in place, and that had been in place at least by the end of the 17th century, you had the money to basically pump into basically what became modern joint stock companies. These can invest in, for example, the production of mass production of coal using the steam engine. Eventually in the 19th century, of course, the creation of railway boom and all that. But basically you can start mechanizing industries where, for example, if you were creating linen back in the day, you could only create so much that people could create. But now when you create the cotton jenny and basically the kind of the looms of the old satanic mills, you can start producing enormous amounts of cheap material. You need far less people to do it, which means you don't have to pay as many people, so the labor costs are down. And basically modern capital, industrial capitalism, was born out of this kind of technological revolution at the time, and with the free availability, or almost free or cheap availability, of capital from the banks. And so that kind of continues on even to the present day. James is always talking about the fact that, you know, none of these tech companies make very much money or any money. Certainly it's been often said, at least from by kind of people in my life, that Netflix is deeply in debt but doesn't seem to make a difference. There's tons of money around. Basically, the technological revolution combined with cheap money is kind of modern capitalism, or certainly what we would call capitalism now. And it goes basically into the present day. So one of the things we're going to be talking about is AI, and at the very least, kind of, I'm going to say the Borgification, to use a Star Trek phrase, of humans, kind of the adding of cybernetic implants in people's brains to deal with pre-existing issues, you know, maybe kind of congenital issues. All of this is kind of just another step. Is there a way to make profit out of it? And again, if you are a fan of kind of dystopian sci-fi, we'll be talking a bit about how that's appeared, kind of horrific views of the future and how that might be have appeared. But in terms of what exists now, it's just another step since, you know, in what began with the steam engine and what began in Scotland in many ways, modern industrial capitalism owing a lot to Scotland.
So if you pick up a newspaper or on social media for any length of time, or if you're paying attention in any way possible, you realize that there is quite a lot of problems facing the world in a variety of different guises, most of which we've already discussed in this podcast at length. But what we haven't really gone into is the complete bird-brained ideas of how we're potentially going to get ourselves out of this mess. And the basic principle is usually that what we see in the capitalist neoliberal society that we live in, very often it's what you would call a technical solution to a social problem. So it will be something along the lines of, oh, we'll just make instead of making homes, we'll make apps, or we'll pay you in cryptocurrency, so your wage will just like wildly fluctuate day to day, hour to hour. So with these things in mind, how do we see in the media and from tech people that often run the media, or at least have large sways in their ability to decide what gets on the news or not, how is it usually framed that technology is going to be the savior?
Yeah, I mean, there's a series of decent documentaries by Adam Curtis that I'll post at the bottom of the podcast. Those series of documentaries kind of cover the kind of how technology has become, or was anyway, seen as the savior of humanity in the 80s and 90s, as basically the figures like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, who are the most famous, came along with a view which is kind of as much influenced by Ayn Rand and kind of libertarian, right-wing libertarian ideologies as anything, but certainly was influenced by the kind of sci-fi that they had grown up with, which again leaned towards the right kind of back in the 50s and 60s. So there was this view that if you can advance society through either the creation of the internet or through the creation of kind of mechanization to such an extent that people just don't need to work anymore, or at least don't need to do the kind of the boring work of life, that they could basically, human civilization will flourish, will bloom, will achieve the type of, you know, Isaac Asimov utopia that kind of science fiction writers have talked about. So there was a real belief back in the 80s and 90s amongst kind of tech gurus that this was going to happen. I don't know how much that is the case now. I don't think it is the case now, but apart from a few isolated individuals. But there was a real feeling that in the 90s that the next stage of human development would be the type of, if not utopia, a far more upbeat version of Blade Runner, you know?
Yeah, I think that the fundamental problem with the idea that technology will save us is it's people not necessarily understanding that technology and humans go hand in hand. I mean, we are a technology. As far as I'm concerned, like the history of human evolution from the point that we stopped sort of physically evolving is the conversation about how our technology has evolved. So you have to... The technology is only as good as the society around it. The way you use that technology, that depends on the people using it. So it's, you can't really say that technology will save us when everyone's a capitalist wanker that just wants to use it to oppress. So this idea of technology being inherently neutral, it's not right. It is solely on the people using it. It's solely on the way it is used. It's potentially there that it could be something that really lifts people out of poverty, you know, really helps with all these problems we face, sort of climate change and all that sort of stuff. But the idea that technology by itself is going to be enough when you're not changing the minds that are using it, it's just bunk, isn't it, at this point? I mean, you look at the promise of the internet versus where we are now, it just doesn't ring true.
I mean, one of the things I often think about is the fact that throughout human history, access to food and the pre-planning of food and where you're going to store it, and, you know, if you have one barred harvest, how terrible that's going to be for your community, you know, is a huge function of like what drives a society to work together, or if not work together, actually fight each other, etc., etc. And now we live in a time of unprecedented wealth where there is basically more than enough food all the time to basically feed everyone, if not an actual fact, feed everyone plenty of times over. But yet we spend a significant amount of that food just throwing it into bins rather than letting hungry people eat it. As me and Alex would know in Edinburgh when we were at our poorest, where we'd go bin raking, and, you know, they would lay traps and, you know, they would try and put bleach in the food. They would rather just bleach your food rather than let someone potentially eat it. And there are situations like that that you lead yourself into where technology has taken us so far, but yet it's, you're right, it's not neutral. It has got this, because the people at the top wield it, it has this massive bias towards it.
Yeah, I mean, but that's always been the case. Technology is always, well, not always, but almost always accentuated class inequality that already was existing. So, for example, if you go back to the mid-late 18th century, you had a huge amount of people living as artisans, as kind of as weavers in parts of England and in parts of Scotland and in Ireland, and had established a fairly decent life. They had their own looms, they could produce their own linen, which there was then kind of collected and shipped off to Belfast in Ireland, or into Glasgow in Scotland, or Lancashire into Manchester and into Liverpool. The development of the kind of the mill system may have produced more and cheaper linen, but it kind of impoverished all those people who were former artisans. They lost their former careers because they could never produce the same amount of linen, or the same consistent quality of linen. So therefore, that's gone out the window, and they're kind of, for the most part, have to either leave the country, leave Ireland, leave Britain, or move into the cities into relative squalor. So, I mean, these types of things have technology has always had periods where a kind of a transitionary period where poverty is made worse. Now, it took most of the 19th and 20th century for some degree of recovery for that. It wasn't really until probably after World War II before people recovered to a certain extent. You know, people started to get some support for housing, for healthcare, and people's kind of living standards kind of got back closer towards and where they had been in the 18th century. You don't hear that a lot because people like to portray technology and the Industrial Revolution as wholly a positive. But asking anybody how they felt in the mid-19th century about what had happened to them and their parents and grandparents, that you wouldn't have heard positive things. That's why you had the Chartists. That's why you had revolutionary movements in Europe and in Britain and Ireland, because you know technology had palpably worsened their lifespan and their standard of life.
This is very on brand to be doing an episode about the future of science and to spend most of it mostly talking about looms.
I just will point out that I'm the history guy. It's Dan's the expert here. So Dan, you need to start talking more.
I think expert is painting it with a nice. Yeah.
That tramadol is really doing work.
It's good for the pain, but it's bad for the brain.
I mean, if we're talking about experts, though, we did, you know, we were looking at articles while we were researching this, and, you know, almost immediately in every article, there was, like, one huge, glaring, like, incorrect information. Like, one we were looking at, one that was about genetic technology and the ability to chart the genome, and the first sentence the guy came out with was that, you know, survival of the fittest was an internal tenet of Darwin's, you know, thesis, when it completely isn't, and in fact it's the complete fucking opposite for Darwin. So, you know, these people get away with murder when they're talking about technology, and I mean murder in the most literal sense, because they're basically, you know, tout these solutions where they effectively say, you know, like, let's take an example where the UK and the US have spent billions, billions and billions on working on apps and by companies that are meant to be, you know, at the forefront of technology, and have just completely pissed all that money away because they're not doing it the most efficiently. But yet you'll easily fool someone in the New Statesman with a little bit of technology jargon to blindside them into thinking that, you know, somehow this person that's never written a line of code in their life runs a company that doesn't have like any coders and is suddenly going to be able to, you know, build a vastly complicated infrastructure to, you know, track and trace. Again, you can fucking do it with a spreadsheet a lot quicker than a lot of these people point out.
Yeah, and I tend to notice that trend where there's no real middle ground. There's people trying to flog their bullshit of what their interpretation of the science is. And then you've got the scientific journals where, you know, they're really talking into the minutiae of sort of what it means, what's coming and all this sort of stuff. And it is really easy to pass off the bullshit to people that don't know anything at all. Well, I like reading scientific journals because I'm that kind of a loser, but I tend to find, like, when you get these people and they're selling what they want to happen rather than what actually might happen. And in some ways it's quite difficult to predict where things will go anyway. I mean, in terms of, say, I think the internet was widely sort of predicted, but the ubiquity of smartphones, I never really saw much about that. That was kind of something that came out of nowhere. So I think a lot of the time they're kind of selling it and they know they can get away with it as well. So it's kind of, because knowledge of science isn't that great amongst your sort of lay journalist, people tend to let them get away with it. So that's, I mean, part of the reason I shared that Economist article was because I thought, well, he's talking a lot of guff, but it's still interesting in terms of, because what I was interested in there was that I think a lot of genetic technology that's coming up, there's real concerns of sort of modern day eugenics, where people who don't necessarily have a moral framework or around the use of genetics could kind of blag people to think, well, if we can get rid of disability, why shouldn't we? And then you talk to disabled people. There's a lot of concern amongst disabled people with the future of genetics, where they're saying, with technology like CRISPR, where you can insert genes and you can remove genes and you can basically remove hereditary traits. Well, is that right to do? Because being disabled is part of the human experience. Is it right to just say, well, we should get rid of all disabilities? You know, that's where I find that sort of, there's no one talking about that stuff other than marginalized groups that are sort of the ones being pushed out by it.
Not to kind of jump the gun for the second episode, but, you know, when I was reading the article that Dan was talking about there, remind me of the movie Gattaca, which was about that very thing, to basically kind of engineering kind of the next generation so that they do not have any kind of, say, they don't have asthma or kind of they'll never need pacemakers or there'll be no autism, all these types of things. And yeah, without kind of going into Gattaca, because I'm sure it'll come up in the next episode, I do think it is interesting, though, that a lot of these ideas do kind of have all the hallmarks of social Darwinism. And it's also interesting that how much that kind of thought process has come in to how people are thinking now. Again, it can be to do with the atomization of people over X amount of decades, however long that's been going on, a long time probably. But it does seem to me that these kind of ideas in a society which has a lot less cohesiveness, a lot less of a sense of collectiveness, that it quite quickly can become a, kind of the type of sociopathic social Darwinism that signified, not to go back in time again, the kind of 19th and early 20th century European empires. Like it's out there. You know, I'm not even talking about the Nazis. We're talking pre-Nazis. You know, it is. You know, one of the articles said very disturbingly that in America alone, 60,000 people were sterilized before the 1950s because they were seen to be disabled or in some fashion not worthy of reproducing. I know that until the 60s, they were still lobotomizing women in America because they were seen as being quote unquote hysterical. So these things are not that long ago, and it's not that hard to imagine that they could, in the right circumstances, reappear, just not as an obvious a fashion. So like Dan said, like, will there even be people with Down syndrome in 50 years if kind of this type of genetic engineering comes along? And even again, if we start augmenting people, like one of the articles was talking about antidepressant medication, which I'm on, and I know that my mood is much, much different when I'm on them than when I'm off them. And he was saying, well, how much, and then the article was saying, how much of who you are is the things that quote unquote aren't working, you know? I do think that's an interesting philosophical discussion in terms of how that works for capital. I mean, capital will try and make money from what it can make money from. So yeah, it seems to go without saying that those who have the money will be able to have super fast and super healthy and super intelligent, in quotation marks, kids, and the poor will end up like the poor of Elysium. Again, another science fiction movie that I'll bring up next episode.
So that's a fairly slapdash, but if an overview of the negatives when it comes to technology, and especially the way that the reins are held by capitalists. So let's maybe look at the reverse of that coin now and think about what can we use technology for, or does science now, or potentially what will be in the future, help us build the anarchist society that we're hoping for?
I'll give it a pop. So I guess if you want to, I'm not necessarily even optimistic, but if you look at something like blockchain technology powering cryptocurrency, it's essentially an open ledger where every node on a chain has access to that ledger and you can see what's been adjusted. So that technology is good for an electronic currency, but it's also quite good for other things where you can use a ledger. So there's one coin at the moment called Cardano. It's also got the network, and they want it to potentially be used as sort of kind of an open source government. So when a decision is made on sort of spending, you can actually see exactly where all that money has gone, and it's in the ledger, and that ledger is accessible to everyone. So in terms of opening up sort of routes to power and like how your money is spent as a taxpayer and all that sort of stuff, there's potential there that it can open that up.
Yeah, one of the articles, and again it'll be posted at the bottom of the episode, talks about the fact that an estimate of somewhere between 30-40% of jobs could be basically cease to be because of automation over the next 20-30 years. Now, it's phrased in the sense that, oh, well, we're going to have 30-40% less jobs, and that's going to be bad because it's going to be unemployment. But this only, again, this is an issue in a society where we force people to do work, or this type of work anyway. There are people have to be earning wage slaves. But you can also look at it from a positive sense, which is there's going to be 30-40% less drudgery, monotonous, boring jobs, or work anyway, that exist in the world. And I do think there, and something even Karl Marx talked about in the fucking 19th century, was that you could, through automation, make life a lot more enjoyable, that all the things that we know we have to do, like bin collection, like the building of roads, like of cafes, restaurants, all the service jobs, you know, all this stuff could, and indeed there's even with the issues that James has with AI, which we'll talk about, I assume, in a second, that even excluding that, you could definitely see how automated work, like cafes and restaurants, could come about rather quickly. They're even talking about automated cars and trucks. That's definitely going to be happening, I think, in our lifetime. These are all good things in a world where you're trying to make life more enjoyable and less kind of monotonous and have less drudgery. So I do think the potential is there. My qualm is not about, per se, the technology. My qualm is about the class system that's going to be perpetuated and made worse by the type of wealth that's created by this. I don't think any of this, what's going to happen to the segment of the population that are who are not having obvious employment? I know this is maybe a controversial thing to say, but it's interesting how the amount of people who are on OnlyFans has increased from like 8 million to 95 million because of the pandemic, because a lot of jobs have disappeared. And again, not all of that is people going, yay, I love OnlyFans. A lot of it is, I need money, and this is a way of doing it. So my worry would be the type of jobs that are going to be, that are still necessary to do because of wage slavery, are going to be, let's just say, not enjoyable. They're going to be something along the kind of OnlyFans, but for people who don't like the type of things that come with OnlyFans. You know what I mean? So my negativity is I think warranted. I do think in a world, like the type of world I would like to create, this type of automation is a good thing, but I don't think within the given the current structures, it would worry me.
Yeah, kind of going on from that, I think when you see the talk of automation, I think the flip side of it is that you will have a lot of people who are out of work. And what happens with those when you sort of got this kind of latent eugenics conversation, as well as sort of a burgeoning sort of eco-fascism where overpopulation is the problem. It's not, you know, the capitalist mode of production that's completely exploiting the planet and resources. But it's because there's too many people. What happens if you kind of have an intersection of those two modes of thought in power, and then sort of automation kind of pushing people out of work in massive swathes, is the view that these people are superfluous to capital and therefore, you know, kind of fuck them? Or is it like, well, they're kind of left to their own devices because automation does everything and we kind of can make people's lives less less drudgery? Or is it kind of like, you're on your own sort of thing? That's the concern with automation for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think technology and science within itself is neutral, but within the framework that we exist in, it's basically used as a cudgel to beat the weakest members of society with, especially when we're talking about automation, where, you know, Like, if you might remember back in, well, obviously we don't, but if you look at literature back in the 60s and 70s, it was effectively like what the computer was going to do was liberate people from work. We're going to live in a post-work society. And if anything, we're working more than we ever have done. People that are now working from home are more productive, but partly that is, you know, they're being spied on more at home than they ever were in the workplace. So it's not being like these things are not coming to fruition in the way that people had hoped. They're being changed and used against us at an alarming rate.
Just want to kind of try and introduce a note of small degree of optimism. I do think there's something to be said. Again, this is my perspective on anarchism, the particular type of libertarian socialism I believe in, that it's always been fairly rare. I don't think that's a controversial statement historically. But I do think that the type of people who would be drawn to it, the kind of, again, anarchism has a, in its best form, is trying to combine kind of a form of individualistic or individualism and kind of collective socialism together, as hard as that may be. But I do think that, given the examples in the past, that the type of, you know, pirate republics of the 17th century, the type of levelers and diggers from Britain, the various movements that have existed over the years in say Spain, which we did episodes on, or Italy, or in Ukraine, that, you know, anarchism has always been that kind of those groups of kind of people on the fringes. And I do think there's a lot more of that in the here and now. And it's possible to imagine, though hard, given the ownership of land in the world at the moment, that given a degree of technological innovation, the ability to people to communicate via the internet, via modern technology, that it would be possible to, again, create more of those types of entities, the kind of the pirate republics, the communes on the fringes. And so purely from my kind of semi-pessimistic attitude, there is ground there for a small degree of optimism as to what as to what happens to that, whether we get a, you know, whether those groups or entities are wiped out or whatever is a different story. But I do think that the mainstream of society may well go one direction, but I think there are also more opportunities opening on the fringes that technology may help develop. So that's my attempt at being optimistic.
I mean, I think there is a good amount of elbow room to be optimistic in, but it's sort of rethinking in what format that we're going to see the future. I know, as I've said previously in the podcast, 24-hour electricity on the route that we're on is not a likely scenario that we'll be seeing. But it's difficult to know what might be coming down the pipeline. You know, there's always usually been some sort of technical fix. Now, in some ways, that's always led to more catastrophe, especially on the climate, you know, since we moved from wood to whale oil to, you know, actual oil, you know, to now that we're in the, you know, looking at a post-carbon future. But, you know, in terms of like, if we can keep kind of what we've got but change it, then yeah, you are looking at like a much better universe to live in, world to live in, because, you know, things like when you see like biofarms, the way that they're potentially going to be pushed forward if that becomes viable, whereas I think it's something like the protein of the world could probably be made in like the Sahara Desert effectively, or when it comes to like renewable batteries, or these potential innovations that we could be seeing. The problem is that governments who, you know, at the moment do genuinely have the money in one way or another, if it is just the banks being able to print it, are not funneling the money into these avenues. They're, you know, they're funneling them to their dodgy mates with websites that are got terms and conditions from Chinese takeaways. So that's really where the problem comes in. You know, as we were saying, like, technology itself is neutral, but it's the people that are behind the technology aren't. So we'll kind of move on. Though I guess we didn't really build our anarchist future with sides too well in that scenario. But
no, I think it's, James, just to kind of again to be a brutal optimist here, in a situation where society collapses, which we have, I don't think it's too much to suggest, we've brought this up multiple times. We had an whole episode about civilization collapse. Opportunities for things to come out of that are there. I think it's very, very hard, given the way the world is now, the type of class structures, the just inability to move politically through parliamentary system, which we don't find surprising, but many people find very frustrating. I don't see it, given the current structure of society, but we keep talking about society collapsing, and I do think there's a good case for it collapsing, maybe not in our lifetimes, but certainly close enough to it. As to what comes out of that kind of collapse, I do see possibilities. It depends on how much technology is preserved. But you can definitely see how a lot of the things that would make a more sustainable society already there now, whether it be the existence of the internet, the existence of solar power. I use solar panels on my boat where I live. It's pretty good for most of the day, especially during the summer, of course. So there are, all those things are there. In many ways, technology is not really the problem. It's kind of society, the society riven by class stratifications, the issue, you know? I suppose that's how I would see it. Like, I can see an anarchist society or these communes or entities coming out of a collapsed society or even on the fringe of the existing one. People often, Ursula Le Guin, the great writer we will talk about in the next episode, she often posited that, you know, it would be off-world if we ever made it off-world, that would happen. I do think it's possible, and you can definitely see a better world is, given what we know and what we could do, possible. I just don't see it coming out of the existing society, you know? But I suppose if we want to count on society collapsing, then yeah, I suppose it's possible.
Yeah, I was just basically going to say what you just said. I think when you look at things like sort of microscale and local power generation, sort of 3D printing technology, communication networks, and all that sort of stuff, I think that it's a better time to be an anarchist than it ever has been in history, really, because there's so much potential there for you to do your own thing completely off-grid without having to rely on anyone else, or at least relying on your own networks rather than sort of government. I think if we were to go into sort of a collapse or a partial collapse, you'd probably see this sort of ground level thing come to the fore more so. Because ultimately, when a central government collapses or just retreats from sort of the fringes of a society, then people will pick up that slack and the tools are there to do that. So I think cautious optimism is pretty warranted. I don't think that technology is a savior, but if you're of the mind where you want to use it to sort of help people around you, it's definitely a better time than it ever has been for that.
So what do we think then, given all this, what we've discussed so far, the next 20 years, what does that sort of look like? What do we think?
I would be more interested if we moved a bit further beyond maybe to 50 to 60 years on, because there's some interesting things there. Again, it depends completely on whether you are an optimist on this or whether you're a pessimist. The pessimists say there'll never be AGI, automated general intelligence. One of the things I read suggested it could happen within the next 35 years. So I don't know, like, it depends on our time frame. I would be interested in that idea, though. I mean, again, it's not really something we've talked about yet, but the idea of a singularity, the creation of artificial intelligence. Now, again, a lot of things would have to happen for that to happen. I don't think there's the capability right now. I think we have like several billion neurons in our brain, and I think the most reasonable a computer has is several times, multiple times smaller than that. So, and there's all sorts of other things that go into type of sentience, you know? So I'm not saying that that's a given, but some of the estimates are in that range. And I do think if you had that, you're talking about something that is, I don't know if there's a comparison I can think of, really. Maybe the type of revolutions that came with, the advent of Islam or of Christianity or whatever, in terms of what that would do to a society. We'd be creating a new race in theory. Again, that's a debated thing, as you guys will no doubt respond. But if that was possible and that did happen, that would be amazing. I think people have said it would be the greatest thing humanity ever did, and it would be the last thing humanity ever did. So if that was to happen, I think that would be, I think that would be amazing. Maybe something we should talk about.
Yeah, I think the idea of the singularity was probably, it's so incomprehensible how much that would change things that it's difficult to say what would come beyond that. I think to get there, I think you're really going to need sort of quantum computing. There are quite a lot of advances being made in that field. It's definitely something where people are working on it. And I mean, if you look at where we were 10 years ago with it compared to where we are now, we're a lot further along, but there's still a lot of tech that needs to catch up. A lot of sort of research still needs to be done to even start to put that together. So I think something like singularity, you're probably, if it's going to happen, you're probably looking at sort of 50, 60 year scale. In terms of closer scale, I think the way that algorithms run, running everything in the background sort of thing, that would become a lot more prevalent. I think ultimately machine learning is going to improve the more data it gets fed. Not that it's perfect or will ever really compare to sort of having a person there doing the job, but I think it will improve to the point where there's a lot of stuff sort of, it can just take over. Again, it would be more of an automation of sort of clerical side of life, not just physical manufacturing and all that sort of stuff. The one that interests me is sort of augmentation and genetics, but I think genetics is difficult to know where that's going to go. I think mostly it'll be medical sort of disease treatment and all that sort of thing. I mean, the optimists in the field reckon anyone alive now could potentially live for another 1,000 years, depending on your perspective. It could be horrific or it could be great. But I think there's that potential there right now. And then sort of, I think if you're going to look at something that sort of stratifies a class system, I think you're looking at sort of cybernetic enhancements, sort of augmented sort of brain capacity stuff. I don't know, say if you lose an eye, you get a digital eye sort of thing that's far more advanced than a human eye. And I think if we reach that point with technology, you will be looking at a really two-tier society where you've got people that are augmented and people that aren't augmented, and the cost of these augmentations would be so far out of range of any reasonable human's sort of price that they could afford, that I think you would be looking at almost a two-tier human society.
Just a brief thing, I think, and again, it's something we'll talk about next episode as well, but I do think the type of kind of techno-feudalism that has begun to develop now will probably get much, much worse. And without the musical stylings of Vangelis, the type of Blade Runner society is a possibility. Maybe not in 20 years, which is what the time frame of the movies are, but certainly over the next century.
I mean, I think overall, I would say I'd kind of go with a little bit more of a pessimistic overview, where I think that we've pretty much seen the top of what we're really going to hit with technology. Not that I think that technology is going to stall within itself, but, you know, again, let's look at the pandemic and the way that that's been borne out by governments absolutely unwilling to do the bare minimum. and every advance that was made that pushed technology forward over the past 100 years was all done by government-funded programs without a single exception. If you're talking about the internet, space program, et cetera, et cetera. So that time is done. And, you know, as you, if you look at human history and you map it, you have technology advances and you have a dark age. And I pretty much see us going into a dark age. I think we're definitely going to take a couple of steps back. And that isn't to say that things still get invented, but I really just don't, on the route that we're on, I just do not see it being a possibility. And even things like, you know, looking at the Blade Runner or anything like it, I think it's just a completely, fantastical. It's as believable as Lord of the Rings in terms of the way that the world is set out, because we live on a finite planet and there's only so much metal in the ground and we're quickly running out of it. There's only so much helium and, you know, there's only so much of it. It's an incredibly important gas and we're selling it, you know, for kids' parties at the moment. But, you know, it's a gas that's hugely important to computer components. And at some point it will be going up enough. So I think we'll be like, I just basically can't go with the optimism that the other two hosts are going with.
Alex, I just wanted to ask a question there in relation to that. But are you suggesting that Elon Musk is lying and that his hope to kind of colonize Mars and to mine metals and whatever else from passing asteroids is just a farcical, ridiculous idea of someone detached from reality who is married to somebody who's equally detached from reality?
Now, the short answer to that would be yes, which is very similar to the long answer, which is yes.
Good to know.
But yeah, it's a complete fantasy because, one, the technology is not there. But second of all, like Elon Musk doesn't even have a car company that is making a profit. So how is he going to expect to put things into space and get them back and forth again? It's just like, I mean, it's science fiction and not in a bad, not in a good way. It's just absolutely drivel. And these are the people that our future is intact with. And they're, you know, they're snake oilmen. And that's to put it generously, because snake oil, no matter what you think about it, was genuinely good if it was proper snake oil for arthritis. And what Elon Musk is proposing is not good for anything. It doesn't, like, it doesn't even make good cars by their own standards. So I just, like, if you just sit down and plot what's actually possible without some sort of like new source of power or complete rethink of society, I just don't see us on the route to Blade Runner. I see us more onto the route of Mad Max.
What about, I know it's a, without breaching this one last question, because I am interested in your response. What about if there was a breakthrough in fusion reactors?
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. Fusion reactors, I sort of also put to the side of, like, it's not even worth thinking about because, like, where are you going to get the material from and what are you going to do with it? So unless it's something along the lines of, like, they're suddenly able to extract it from space somewhere for whatever reason, then I don't really see how it's going to be possible, because you're still going to need metal and potentially, you know, carbon oil to mine it, to produce it, to keep it running, etc., etc.
Cool. Well, that answers my question. I suppose I can then be necessarily brief in my last words. Which is, yeah, I mean, like we said before, technology is only as good as the society that it is producing it, and the individuals who are at the elite within that society. And I think history has proven that, and certainly the present is proving that. I would say that for those listening, that it, much like when before the advent of the internet, that people who are on the margins of fringes of society should seek to work together and organize together with what technologies they have. I'd say that's the same now. I don't think the battle changes because technology changes. Again, unless these major leaps that we were talking about, whether it be fusion or whether it be AGI, comes along very, very quickly for reasons that are detached from what we now know. Then, yeah, I think we're the same battles are there. In fact, they probably are getting more serious as climate change is not being dealt with, even despite the amount of technological advances that have been made, is bearing down upon us quite clearly. And what we do with that is really more to do with the societies and the kind of the activists or organizations we're all part of. I don't think technology really does a lot for that battle. The you know, basically no war but the class war. That doesn't stop because of anything we now know about.
Dan, what's your closing thoughts?
Yeah, I think I'll just make the point that I think Elon Musk is selling Elon Musk. That's what he's about. He's interested in hyping himself, and that's I think anything he says is just in that interest. But yeah, I think taking your point, I don't know if it would necessarily be a dark age. I think there's potential there for stagnation, where we're kind of stuck at this point for quite a while. Optimistically, there are potential technologies there that can sort of revolutionise the world that we're living in. Whether the political will there is there, as you said, to sort of push the research and get us there is another thing entirely. And I don't feel like it's there at the moment for sure. I think we need to really, not just a Green New Deal. I mean, even that is sort of short term. I think you need to really be looking at what is the point of humanity? What do we want to achieve as a race? And I think that until you start having that conversation seriously, it's kind of just an aimless wandering, and technology is just being used to uphold the status quo.
Right, that seems a pretty good place to leave it. Again, another optimistic episode of the Anime Podcast with plenty of looms for the history fans.
Before we finish, for anyone looking for an optimistic version of the future, the movie Star Trek First Contact describes a society having collapsed, being reborn in the ashes, and heading off into space. So if you're looking for an optimistic view of the future, you can watch the next episode. We'll talk about science fiction. Or you can just watch Star Trek, which is communism in space.
So folks, we are always on the hunt for new podcast hosts. So if you want to come on to the podcast and talk about looms, we are more than happy to have you. So send us a message via Twitter or via the email anarchistreadings@gmail.com. And this is the first part of a second part, a two-part. What's a trilogy called when it's just two? A sequality.
A duopoly, I think.
A duopoly, yeah. This is a duopoly. Hey, it's a duopoly over here. Where the next one we'll be talking about science fiction, the genre. So say goodbye to our lovely listeners, Dan.
Goodbye, lovely listeners.
And Alex?
Bye, lovely listeners. Make sure you have an OnlyFans account, because soon that'll be the only way to make money.
Fully automated OnlyFans account. And I've been your host, Jesus Christ. I've been your host. My AI program is really fucked up today. I've been your host, James, and we'll see you next week. See you, folks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.